UCCF's BeThinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on BeThinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to BeThinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
Like many of you, I do a great deal of travel. When you travel, sometimes you want to be left alone. I want to give you a little trip. If people say to you, what do you do for a living? Say to them, I teach philosophy. It's a great conversation killer. I've never ever met anybody who said, philosophy, wow, have I got some philosophical problems for you. But instead, if you want people talk to you and say, what do you do for a living? I say, I teach ethics, which most people think is the county next to Thuthix. And if you say you teach ethics, they all have a friend. And this friend, of course, has lots of ethical problems. And they describe their friend's ethical problem in graphic detail and want you to help them with their friend's problem. Sorry. Philosophy, of course, does have a point, quite apart from what Bill was suggesting this morning. The young man who was not very successful with the opposite sex had a friend who was very successful. And he said to his friend, what's the secret? And his friend said, oh, it's very simple. What you do is you talk to them. Talk to them. But what would you talk to them about? He said, just remember the three F's, food, family, and philosophy. If you can remember the three F's, you are in good shape. So one night he was out, he saw this young lady, he thought, I'd like to get to know her better, but what should I do? And then he remembered, talk to her. So he went over and he said to her, do you like spaghetti? And she said, I hate spaghetti. So that was the food. So family, how's your brother? I don't have a brother, she said. That was family. So only left him philosophy. If you did have a brother, would he like spaghetti then? Giving a lecture is actually a twofold process. I'm going to give what's loosely called a lecture. And what's the point? What is your role? My desire is to help you reflect critically on the practice of apologetics. My desire is to make you reflect on the morality of the practice of apologetics. So all the time, you don't have to remember all the things or even read all the notes, but I do hope that we'll be able together to reflect critically on apologetics and to reflect critically on the morality of apologetics. You always set things in a context. The context is a reflection on the nature of apologetics. We've had many number of different definitions given. It can be a criticism of alternatives. It can be a response to questions and objections from the culture, from the philosophies of place that we have today. It can be a search for common ground and shared criteria. It can be an opportunity to present our own case, as in mission and evangelism. But of course, the reality is that we live in the context of a rejection of apologetics. Partly that's been theological. You know, they say that the history of 21st and 20th century theology is a series of footnotes to Karl Barth. And if you actually read Barth, Barth rejects apologetics. He says it actually undermines the divine revelation. It takes away from God speaking himself indirectly. Therefore, don't practice apologetics. And many people have taken that seriously, certainly in the theology faculties. If you go to Britain, you will hardly find a theology faculty which engages in any kind of practice of apologetics, never mind reflection on it. But it's not just at the theoretical level, it's also at the practical level. The church has rejected and omitted to practice apologetics. I remember in the early 70s speaking at a conference with Os Guinness and John Stott. And over coffee, we were bemoaning the fact that the church then was not interested in apologetics. And Oz and John have struggled over the years to try to create an interest. And they will be delighted at the gathering of this network and the enthusiasm which there is from mealtimes through to every moment. I want to suggest a number of questions that we ought to be asking about the practice of apologetics. Really, this is about the ethics of apologetics. I want to say, first of all, a word of congratulations to the supervising team who put together the program, actually to realize the need to reflect morally on what we are doing, the need to step back and reflect on our practice and ask some hard ethical questions seems to me a very healthy kind of sign. More and more in working with professionals, the professionals are having to become much more self-conscious about why they are doing what they're doing. Much of my work is done with doctors and medical researchers. They're asking the question, what is the morality that drives us? What is the morality of our practice? And how can we make sure that there is good practice rather than bad practice? That should be true for apologists as well. What is the good practice as opposed to the bad practice? I want to set it, first of all, in the morality of a number of concerns. Paul says, woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. Now, there's a cry for the apologist's heart, a genuine desire to communicate the gospel and to do it in a way that touches people and changes lives and communities. That's moved, I think, by a moral concern for the lost. We should be driven by a morality which actually is concerned that people will have a lost eternity. We should be concerned, likewise, that one day we will answer before the judgment throne of God. The reality that we live in, we had this morning from Richard about God's judgment, but God judges us as well. When Bill Craig talks about building not on hay and stubble, we're talking about a reality of judgment. And one day we will have to give an answer to God, not just why did you come to the conference, but what did you do in light of the conference? What difference has it actually made? A concern that one day we'll stand before the judgment seat. It's also a moral concern to obey Christ. What kind of people are we if we hear the gospel, we hear the teaching of Christ, the feet washing incident, Jesus washes their feet and he says, do you understand what I've done? And like a good class, they all say, yes, teacher. And he says, well, blessed are you, not if you pass the test, not if you sit the exam, blessed are you if you do it. You see, obeying Christ is not about knowing Christ. It's not just about analyzing. It's about translating that analysis into good practice. A concern to obey Christ and therefore not to be disobedient. A concern to imitate Christ, to be living copies of Christ, to look at the way Christ used the ability to get alongside people, the ability to analyze people, the ability to relate the gospel to people, and the way to bring about transformation. A concern to imitate Christ. And of course, if we take seriously what's already been said in a number of sessions, that actually apologetics is not going to be about people liking you and thinking, oh, what a great guy, we must invite him or her again for dinner. But actually, there will be a level of suffering, a level of rejection, and we can imitate and copy Christ in the fact we suffer. But let's make sure we suffer for Christ's sake rather than because we behave in totally unacceptable ways. A concern also, I think, to imitate New Testament methods. New Testament was given to us not just an interesting book to read, it's an authoritative God's word to us, which sets out ways of communicating the gospel, ways of engaging in persuasion, ways of doing apologetics. There is a concern, a moral concern, to imitate New Testament methods. It also is a moral concern to be sensitive to the Spirit's leading. We read time and again in Acts how whether it was an individual or the church community was guided and directed by the Holy Spirit. Think of all the things that we could possibly do, all the books that you could possibly read, all the people you could possibly evangelize, all the issues you could study in terms of apologetics. How do we decide? Well, you can stick a pin in, or we can pray and believe that God will guide and direct us. His Holy Spirit will lead us, not just to the theme, but to the individuals, to the opportunities whereby we can be able to share our faith. The morality of concerns, concern for the lost, concern we'll answer before the judgment seat, concern to obey Christ, concern to imitate Christ, concern to imitate New Testament methods, and to be sensitive to the Holy Spirit's leading. But I want also to reflect on the morality of truth. You see, we're dealing with truth here, and truth is, I believe, a moral concern. We should be concerned morally to rebut the lies of relativism. I had a friend who was an Old Testament scholar. He was visiting the US, giving various lectures. And the trouble with being a kind of hit-and-run lecturer is every now you run out of lectures to give. And he ran out of lectures, so he thought, what will I do? I'll go to the university library. went to the university library and thought, oh, I'll see whether they've got any interesting journals. He saw a journal he'd never seen before, Old Testament journal. He picked it up. He said, oh, it'll be interesting. You know, I'll see if there's any interesting articles. There was an article, and he thought, that's an interesting article. I'd like to read that. So he began to read it, and he said, this is very familiar. Indeed, it's very, very familiar. Indeed, I wrote this article. And here was so-and-so from Sun State University. So my friend wasn't very thrilled, so he phoned up this guy and said, this article that you've written in this journal, it's my article. And the man said, oh, that's right, you should be flattered. You know, I was coming up for tenure. I needed one more publication. I looked round for an article that most people wouldn't have read, and I thought, I will take this and I will publish it. Truth. The scientific, the academic community depends on an understanding of truth. And the danger is that we live in a world where there is a denial, a view that truth is not universal, that truth has not something to say, that truth is in fact totally relativistic. And all of you as good apologists will know it's self-contradictory. Elaine outlined that yesterday. It's inaccurate. It actually is not true. It's not true either in the moral realm, where there is a core of morality, and if you examine that core of morality, it relates very clearly to the Ten Commandments. There are always rules about parent-children relationship, always rules about sexual behavior, always rules about the sanctity of life, always rules about truth-telling, always rules about what belongs and what doesn't belong. These are universal values that God has given to all humanity. You cannot have a community without that core. And so it's important that we show the inaccuracy of relativism. And of course, actually, if you reflect very carefully on it, what it does is it absolutizes one particular view of truth. We should have a moral concern, actually, to rebut the lies of relativism. We should also have a moral concern to make sure that we use proper methods of truth. It's interesting, Bill's reaction to one of the questions, the danger of using illicit means in order to bring about what we regard as a good. Does the end justify the means? Oh, well, people were gloriously converted. The fact that it was done through the use of the Inquisition, does the end justify the means? Well, no. We want to suggest there are some means that may be wrong. And therefore, truth and a proper use of truth and proper testing of truth is vital. I suggested three main philosophical categories. Coherence. If it doesn't make sense, if it is not self-contradictory, if it is not actually something which is coherent, it's nonsense. If it doesn't correspond with reality, if it doesn't give an accurate kind of description of reality, then how can it be true? And then, of course, if it doesn't actually change and transform people, that real truth actually changes people. Real truth actually transforms not just individuals, but communities and societies. When we heard from Greg about Wilberforce, here was truth actually beginning to fundamentally to alter society, community, law, and world perspectives. A concern for a proper test of truth. But also a concern, I believe, to resist subjecting Christian truth to false standards. I think one of the troubles in living in what's called a postmodern world, I'm not very convinced, but if there is such a thing as a postmodern world, then I think that the danger is that we take Christian truth and we apply false kinds of standards to it. And we need to reject that in the same way as we need to reject control of theological thinking through tying it to some current philosophy. If you marry the spirit of the age, you will end up a widower and lose everything. That's the reality. If I read Aquinas, I find that Aquinas has a great deal to offer, but I find that Aquinas is so dependent on Aristotle and Aristotelian physics that much of his accounts of the proofs of God run into fundamental difficulties. If you tie your particular apologetic to a particular culture of the age and absolutize that, then you will actually undermine the nature of Christian truth. We should have a concern to make sure not just that we resist using false standards to judge Christian truth, but using false kind of philosophical and theological and cultural categories simply as ways of controlling the truth of Christianity. I'll talk a little bit more about that. But I think there's also a moral concern that we should have in the truth itself. It was lovely to hear this morning those readings from Scripture at the beginning of the day from Stefan about the truth. If you'll know the truth, then the truth will make you free. Just 3 weeks ago, I was in the U.S. Interviewing some people, and the other person who was interviewing said to them, have you ever read Flannery O'Connor? and one or two of the people being interviewed said they had. And they said, I want to read you a quote from O'Connor and see what you think of it. And they quote, you shall know the truth, O'Connor said, and the truth will make you odd. Now, it seemed to me very interesting. In what sense has the truth made us odd? What kind of oddity have we as Christians? We talk about the truth making us free. We should have confidence that the truth will change and transform us. I love that little poster that people have on the wall. You know, please be patient with me. God hasn't finished with me yet. The truth is carrying on, changing us, transforming us. It's not a kind of one-off. It's not, you know, all happens in the conversion experience and that's the end. I'm always frightened when people just tell me about the conversion experience. Don't tell me anything about the last 30 years and what God has or has not been doing in their life, continuing to change and transform. Let's have some confidence, a moral confidence in the truth, which actually changes and helps people grow. But if we're going to reflect on the ethics of apologetics, we need also to reflect on the morality of persons and relationships. One of the key themes that people have described about post-modernity, and as again a number of the other speakers have referred to, is a concern that we show integrity. And I believe that it is a moral responsibility for us to act with integrity. In teaching ethics in the university in Oxford, often you look at the whole nature of conscience. And, you know, we have a great way of teaching in Oxford. It's absolutely wonderful. What happens is you give people a reading list and you send them away and they read for a week. And then they come back and they read their essay aloud to you and you say, well, thank you very much, and you make some comments. And we call this teaching. It's absolutely wonderful. So over the years, I've been teaching in Oxford now for 24 years, and I've listened to many, many essays on conscience. And so I've learned a little bit about conscience. It's a great way of learning without having to read the books yourself. And it's interesting, in conscience, the one thing that people always tell me when they read essays or write essays about conscience is you should never go against your own conscience. You know, Jiminy Cricket's advice to Pinocchio was always let your conscience be your guide. And there is a sense where there is a lack of integrity in an individual who knows that something is wrong and fails to do it. A lack of integrity in the person who knows that something is good and right and fails to do it. That's why Paul says, the good that I would, I do not, and that which I would not, yet I do. O wretched man that I am, who will save me? And the only one who will save, of course, is Jesus Christ, who actually gives us an integrity. We should be concerned with the integrity of ourselves, actually telling people what we actually believe and why we believe it. Not just enough to tell people that we believe, we need to show that there are good reasons, which is why the passage that Greg referred to from Peter is so important. It's giving good reasons for the hope that is within us. A concern for the integrity, not just of ourselves, but of others. As you read the New Testament, you see more and more how Jesus, and indeed not just Jesus, gave people integrity. He showed a genuine respect for people in that he took them seriously. He took the rationality seriously. You see, even the most severe postmodern has a streak of rationality. I remember Don Carson lecturing about relativism in Cambridge, and one young woman said, you know, I do not believe in these kinds of standards. You know, truth is all individual. And he said, well, if I'm marking your exam and I decide that I don't like you and fail you, how would you feel about it? Well, that wouldn't be fair. But you know, truth is just how I happen to feel it, and I just happen to feel that, you know, this essay isn't really something that I like, so I'm going to fail it. Oh, you can't do that. That's wrong. It's very interesting that there is a rationality there. Often it's hidden. Often it's got lots of other layers. But we can find and we can appeal to that rationality. I do a lot of work in schools, high schools, 17, 18-year-olds. And it's interesting as you go around talking to all these kinds of groups, how often they want to have good reasons why they should or should not do something. They want to understand what the rationale behind something is. They don't want to be told what to do, but they do want to know why they should or should not do something. They want to be given the reasons and then work out whether or not they will accept or reject the reasons. There is a rationality, and part of respecting other people is respecting the fact that they are made in the image of God, that they think God's thoughts after them, after God, that they have a rationality. I was taught by T.F. Torrance in Edinburgh. And Torrance used to have a lovely saying, and his saying was that there is an inherent intelligibility in the nature of things, and there is an inherent intelligence in the nature of people. And both the inherent intelligibility in the nature of things and the inherent intelligence in people, in other words, let's put it the simple version that I understand, which is that the world makes sense and God has made us so that we can make sense of the world which makes sense. But whether or not it's the world makes sense, God made the world make sense. And whether or not it's we can make sense of the world, it's God gives us the sense so that we can make sense of the world. There is a rationality which is fundamental to human being, and we need to give that respect and to recognize it's part of giving others their integrity. It's also holistic. John Stott says what he doesn't like about academia is that it creates tadpoles, people who have huge heads and not much else to them. And the danger is that, whether it's in philosophy or theology or ethics or whatever your specialism is, that we teach people who have huge amounts of knowledge and there's nothing else to them as people. And they are crippled as people. We must be holistic in the presenting of our apologetic, in the sharing of the gospel. But also we must not be paternalistic. Paternalistic. Spurgeon, when he preached, said, "You preach as one who is a leper to those suffering from leprosy." You don't preach as somebody who is so superior that I'm going to deign to share a little bit of my knowledge with you. I remember Socrates, when the oracle at Delphi had announced that Socrates was the wisest man, and he came back and they told him, and they all expected Socrates to jump up and down with joy. "Wowee, I am the wisest man in the world." He said, "Well, the only reason they think I'm the wisest man in the world is because I know all the things that I do not know." We need to recognize the limits of our knowledge, the limits of our understanding. And if anything that should make us realize that paternalism is the death of good apologetics, it's a recognition. Look in the mirror. Look in the mirror and look at yourself. That's what I do in the morning. That's what keeps me reasonably humble, looking in the mirror in the morning. A concern for the integrity of ourselves, a concern for the integrity of others, also a concern for the freedom and the autonomy of others. We live in an age where people emphasize freedom, they emphasize autonomy. In medical ethics, it's the great mantra, we must maximize autonomy. I spend much of my life debating limits of autonomy. But what's interesting, I find, in the New Testament, is here's a man, a rich young ruler, who comes along to Jesus, and he's a very nice young man. Very attractive young man. He's also very well off. And the beauty of this guy is he is interested in spiritual things. He wants to have a spiritual discussion with Jesus. And he's come to Jesus. Here is this man who does miracles. Here's this man who has this absolutely incredible teaching. Here's this man who has the secret of eternal life. And this rich young ruler, in his desire to know and to understand, says to Jesus, "Master, I know that you have the secret of eternal life. Share it with me." And Jesus asked them about the commandments. And this young man is not just rich and not just attractive, not just interested in spiritual things. Morally, he is the best. "I have kept all the commandments since my early ages." And then Jesus says, "There's only one thing you've got to do. Go sell everything that you have. You give all these things away. And then you come and follow me." And the rich young ruler says to the King of Glory, "Thank you very much, Jesus. But no, thank you very much." People were felt free to say no to Jesus Christ. Now, if people were free to say no to Jesus Christ, they should certainly be free to say no to me and also no to you. The reality of the gospel, the reality of a concern, a moral concern for the freedom and autonomy of others, is that Jesus gives people the freedom to reject him. That God in his wisdom and his sovereignty, gives us the freedom to say no to God. So we should not be surprised if we do not have 100% success. We should not be surprised if people reject. Make sure they're rejecting the gospel rather than rejecting us. Sometimes people present us in the way that we present it rather than the gospel and the gospel truth itself. We must make sure that we do not blackmail people into the kingdom. We do not trick people into the kingdom. That we do not force people into the kingdom. A concern for the freedom and the autonomy of others. But also a concern for the culture of others. Now, I don't pretend to have the answer here. I went to India, to Bangalore. In the meetings I spoke at, I was invited by an Indian, a Christian Indian, to his home. And I went home with him. When we arrived, the table was set. It was set for two, for this man and for myself. And I was introduced to his wife, and I was introduced to his mother-in-law. Now, I could understand him not wanting to eat with his mother-in-law, but not even with the wife. And I found that very embarrassing. And I said, please, you know, aren't the ladies going to join us? Oh, no, no, no. And, you know, how far do you force your culture on other people? There needs to be an apologetics, a sensitive awareness of culture. These are thoughts, these are not answers, but it's a raising of questions for you to reflect on your practice. We've heard today about the cultures where the Orthodox church is very strong, and that's a different kind of culture. And we mustn't pretend that in apologetics one size fits all. That's a real danger. We come along with one simple kind of apologetic method and say, you've all got to do it this way, whereas in fact that's totally culturally insensitive. It's not taking people seriously. I'm concerned in cultures to say, what actually is a proper human identity and what is an inhuman, what is a divisive thing about the culture? I have a friend who works in a hospice, he's the chaplain of a hospice in Edinburgh, and he went to see Braveheart. You know, that wonderful unbiased presentation of the relations between the Scots and the English. And after he came out of Braveheart, now this is a gentle, loving, gracious, hospice man. And he came out and he said, I'd have killed the first Englishman I met. Now you need to have some kind of cultural sensitivity. And that's a moral concern. How can I do justice to this other person in his or her culture in a way that is part of their identity and part of what it means to be human? And are there features of my culture and your culture which actually are inhuman, actually divide and destroy human beings rather than help them grow and flourish? But also a moral concern when we're talking about person and relationships, a concern for the destiny of other people. I like the story of Wesley, who was training preachers. Probably he would have trained apologists if he'd only known properly what apologetics was. But in training them, he used to say, when you go out and speak about heaven, let your light, your face shine like the glory of heaven. Let it shine like the sunshine. When you preach about hell, your ordinary face will do. Now... Our problem is not the ordinary face, but that we don't like to preach about hell. We don't like to preach about judgment. But you see, you cannot escape from the reality of hell and judgment in all the pages of the New Testament. And so it's crucial for us in reflecting on how are we genuinely concerned for other people. This man, this woman is lost. I used to take part in a program called the Moral Maze. It was a discussion program. The young kind called it the Moral Zoo. And in this program, the Moral Zoo, we had a lawyer. We always try to have a lawyer. Though why, goodness knows. We had a journalist, a right-wing fascist. And we had myself, supposedly the Christian, the middle-of-the-road, philosophically balanced human being. And we had a gay activist who's a well-known gay historian. Now, this man called David Starkey is one of the rudest men, and that's his sobriquet in the UK. Elaine once was on the programme and put him down in a beautiful way. But David Starkey is very rude. And people say, how do you cope with this man? Because he constantly interrupts, he constantly badgers, he reduces people to tears, he shouts, he screams, he's awful. And I say, the only way I can cope with him is to remember he's somebody for whom Christ died. Because the reality is that he's a hurting man. He's a hurting man, not just suffering in this life. He may be paid £2 million to make 6 TV programs, but he's a hurting man, and he will hurt in eternity. And that's what should drive us, a genuine concern for people and their lost eternity. But we need to talk, if we're going to talk Richard's three-point analysis, vision and strategy, we need to be talking about the morality of methodology. And I suppose if you gave any thought before you came and you looked at the topic, the ethics of apologetics, this is really what you thought I would speak about, rather than talking about the morality of concerns and the morality of truth and the morality of persons and relationships. I do want to talk about the morality of methodology, because how we do things, why we do things, matters morally. We must be able to pass that moral test, how we do it, why we do it. I have a friend who died not very long ago of motor neuron disease. And when she was first diagnosed, She was a pianist, and she discovered she couldn't play properly because her stretch was going. She couldn't get the range. She went to see her GP, and after all the tests, he said to her, "You have motor neuron disease." And she said, "Well, what's that?" And he tried to describe it to her. So she said, "Well, what's going to happen to me?" He says, "Well, what's going to happen to you is you're going to choke to death." Now, every night when she went to sleep, she used to waken up thinking that she was choking to death. He told her the truth. But he told her in a very unpleasant, destructive way. And that woman and her family's 2 years of life were totally ruined by a very insensitive methodology. You can tell people the truth. You can tell it in such a way as to destroy people. And so how we do things is important. There is a morality, and ought to be a morality, in a concern to do justice to the nature of gospel truth. See, part of the difficulty is that often we fasten on one aspect of the truth. Remember the debate between the Anglican and the Baptist. I'm a Baptist, by the way. They're discussing, you know, that innocuous issue of believers' baptism. And so the Anglican said, "Look, if I was standing in my knees in the water, wouldn't that do?" "No, no, no." The Anglican said, "If I was standing up to my waist in the water, wouldn't that do?" "No." "Standing up to my chest in the water, wouldn't that?" "No," says the Baptist. "I was standing up so the water was lapping on my forehead, wouldn't that do?" "No." "See," says the Anglican, "it's that little bit on the top of your head that's really important." Now, notice I do tell that as a Baptist against myself. I love the story of two well-known Christians in Edinburgh who were debating, and they were on the same platform. And one said to the other, "We disagree about how much water we should use, when and where it should be applied, but we're one in Christ. And we need to be true to the real nature of the gospel. What matters? What is fundamental? And what is a proper understanding of the gospel, the whole gospel, not the bits we like, not just the bits we agree with, but the whole gospel of Christ?" I think also we need to avoid the commercialization of the gospel. The commercialization. And I want you to avoid the commercialization of apologetics. Here we are, the largest tract. Didn't we do well? Oh, we are wonderful. You see, and we can become a big success story rather than actually concerned about doing justice to the gospel and to people. The commercialization, the success motif, where we sell the gospel rather than sharing it, rather than proclaiming it, where the quantity of the fruit becomes much more important than the quality of the fruit. Teaching in Oxford, our teaching is all done one-on-one. It's a very, very expensive way. But boy, oh boy, how you can change and transform one individual, even just in 8 hours over a term, as you teach and concentrate solely on that individual and his or her writing style, his or her thinking, his or her presentation, his or her understanding. It's the individual. The quality is more important than the quantity. Let's not be carried away with a commercialization of the gospel. New Testament calls us, yes, indeed, to be fruitful, but it calls us to be faithful. And that faithfulness is to be fundamental, being faithful to the gospel. I think of men and women who in ministry situations have given a lifetime and seen very little fruit. But they have sown all kinds of good things that in years to come and in God's goodness there will be a blessing, there will be a fruit. Faithfulness, a concern to avoid the commercialization of the gospel. I think also in apologetics in particular, and this is true in all evangelism, there should be a concern for the wrong kind of consensus. Sometimes there is a temptation, I know the temptation only too well, particularly if you're chairing a meeting. What you look for is the lowest common denominator. What you look for is what you can all get away with and all go home and feel, "I got a little something. Didn't get everything, but I got something." The trouble is we emasculate the gospel. We actually destroy the truth of the gospel. Let's beware of a wrong kind of consensus, which is more important in soothing people's feelings than doing justice to the truth. The wrong kind of consensus. Beware of the lowest common denominator. There should be also morally a concern for holism. We shouldn't separate the personal from the communal. So often when we read the New Testament, "You are the salt of..." "I am the salt of the earth." "I am the..." "You together are the salt of the earth." "You together..." We shouldn't separate the personal from the communal, nor the private from the social. I just have two things to say in relation to that. One is called Bill and the other Clinton. There was an example of separating the personal, the private, from the communal, from the social. Do we really believe that it doesn't matter what happens in a person's own life, what matters in the privacy? Is there that kind of distinction? Should we buy into that? Or do we believe that the gospel is holistic, and we in our presentation of the gospel and in our treatment of people also need to have a concern for the whole of the gospel, the whole of the people we're dealing with, the whole of the context, and our holism as well? A concern also, though, I think, for plurality. Plurality. Variety, I believe, is God's gift. It's not just a human reality. It's also a gift of God. Elaine, many years ago, wrote on the whole subject of what's right with Christian feminism. Very interesting and proper twist there. It was a twist because, sadly, in some feminism, in some response to feminism, what's happened is that we have tried to play down variety. And certainly, if you look around the room, you see a great deal of variety. And it's important. God has given us a gift of variety. And part of what it means to be European is to be part of a wonderful variety. America itself is actually much more like Europe. If you look at the East Coast and the West Coast and then the Deep South and then the Midwesterners, they're all as different as the different Europeans are different. And they have cultures all of their own. And you need to be culturally sensitive. But there is a variety there. Let's have a proper concern for plurality. And I think in apologetics, that's about a plurality of methodologies. It's a plurality of context into which we speak. It's a plurality of different styles. We've been hearing, and there are many others here, I know, who are engaged in the work of apologetics. And that is a trap for people who train apologists. I've been training people in preaching and apologetics, for 30-odd years, some of them very odd. And over those years, what's interesting is that sometimes people say, but I'm not you, as if I want them to be like me. I remember going up to the fertility clinic and they told me they were desperately short of sperm, David. And then he said a little bit more and they said, we're desperately short of sperm, David. And after about half an hour of this, where every time sperm was mentioned, they all looked in my direction and said, David. I said, hold on. Why is it that every time you mention the shortage of sperm, you look at me and you say, David, you know? And they said, well, you know, we thought that you would like a world peopled with David Cook lookalikes. I said, no, I couldn't stand the competition. Now, it's not just not wanting to stand the competition. It's actually there is a variety. We want people to be themselves. There isn't one hoop for you all to jump through to be good apologists. God has given you particular gifts. And part of a proper training and development is taking you as God has made you and refining those gifts, developing those gifts, making sure that you are able to be the person that God created you to be and to fulfill the task that He is calling you to fulfill. A concern for plurality. Variety is God's gift. But also a concern for faith. Now, this is a little bit contentious, but it'll be interesting perhaps to reflect on this in the question time. Keith Ward started life off as an atheist and agnostic. Then he had a Christian experience and became a cleric. And now he's into Indian philosophy, so he's travelled all kinds of ways. In that movement, when he first began to talk about faith, he said, if we could produce 100% proof of God's existence, then it would be irrational not to be a Christian. It would be so overwhelming that everybody would have to believe. And if you'd have to believe, there would be no freedom not to believe. That faith, we walk by faith rather than absolute certainty. And faith always leaves open that possibility of doubt. Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. Now, I'm sure there's a right kind of tension here, and perhaps others can help us grapple with what is a right tension between believing and knowing truth, as opposed to being open to the possibility there is something yet to learn, there is something yet to understand. Do you believe that you have grasped all of God's nature? Do you believe that you understand all of God's truth? Do you believe you have nothing to learn from the Scripture? If so, I'd really like to meet you, because you are very, very unusual and exceptional. No, there must be a faith, a proper concern for faith. And in the early church grew, developed, not because everybody agreed. Much of the New Testament epistles would never have been written if early Christians agreed about everything. It was because there was a realm of disagreement that they were able to help us reflect on Christian truth. Colossians would never have been written if there wasn't a heresy at Colossae. Romans would never have been written, and part of Romans would never have been written, certainly unless the Scots and the Jews, you know, wanted a bargain on the one side, and then the English and the Pharisees on the other, who saw cheap meat, you know, and said, no, you can't eat that, it's been offered to idols. And so you had this division about food and eating meat offered to idols, with the Scots and the Jews on the one side, the English and the Pharisees on the other, and we, of course, know what truth lay there. It was because there was disagreement, and as Christians and as evangelicals, often we fear disagreement. If you believe all truth is God's truth, you have nothing to fear from disagreement. Science proceeds by the nature of disagreement, seeking to find some truth through the disagreement. And likewise, we can use faith to discover more certainty. In content and in context in the early church, there was a concern for faith. What is proper faith? And what is the wrong kind of certainty? I'm sure there's a right kind of certainty as well as a wrong kind. We need to have a proper understanding of tolerance. I'd really like to have done much more in this, much more justice to this. As you know, often in other countries, what we're hearing from Amy and what we're recognising often in many other countries is that there is an intolerance toward Christianity. Secular humanism in particular is very intolerant of Christianity because it believes that Christianity is intolerant. Now, we have to find a way of expressing and showing that there is nothing genuinely intolerant about Christianity. That there's a world of difference between standing for the truth and expressing the truth in a loving way and acting in intolerant manners. And so we need a proper understanding of tolerance and extremism. And so often fundamentalism, so often people who believe in fundamentals are caricatured as people who are extremist and as people who are intolerant. We have to find ways, particularly in our apologetic, of so presenting the truth that it shows a genuine kind of openness. I was interested in that passage in Bill's lecture today where he talked about spending 1 year reading this, 2 years reading that, 3 years reading The City of God. It was interesting the choice of the piece that you read and how long you spent on each of it. But I spent 1 year in Edinburgh University, which is a real university, not like Oxford. But in Edinburgh... We spent 1 year reading one chapter of Bradley's Principles of Logic. 1 year reading one chapter. Now, I knew a lot about that chapter. We also spent the next year, 1 year, reading Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. And in the finals, what you got was you got five quotations from Kant which were not annotated. You had no idea where they came from. And you had to write about all five. And so you were invited to, you had to know the context, you had to know the argument, you had to do something with that. That's how familiar you had to be. I just wish that my students were as familiar with the Bible as they are with some of their philosophical and theological texts. We need to have an understanding. But one thing I did learn in that class on Bradley, he was an idealist, philosophical idealist, very famous at the turn of the century, in case you don't know anything about Bradley and the idealist. And Bradley... He used to say the completely open mind is the completely empty mind. The completely open mind is the completely empty mind. You see, we need some categories to think properly. We need some categories to understand. We need some categories to understand. And whether it's culturally, whether it's socially, whether it's intellectually, we have to have some means of understanding and interpreting the world. The open-minded, yes, but beware of empty minds. But also I want to talk about the morality of a concern for appropriate methods. Christians need to get away from force and violence, and there are all kinds of force and violence that we can use. Doctors in white coats saying to a patient, let me just give you the example. I said on the Research Ethics Committee in Oxford, we had a heart specialist, and he wanted to do a clinical trial. It's a fascinating clinical trial. He'd come to the theory that if you gave people a mild heart attack, when they then went on and had a serious heart attack, they'd do really well. So what he wanted to do was to give people a mild heart attack. And so he'd managed to persuade 30 patients that they would be given a mild heart attack. And so it came to the ethics committee, and we said no. And he was very angry, and he asked if he could come present. And we said, yes, come along. And he presented that, you know, his theory was absolutely the case, and he must be given this freedom to give people heart attacks so they would do better when they had a serious heart attack. And we said, well, it's not a very good idea to give people a heart attack, and we're not sure you can make sure it's just going to be a mild heart attack rather than a serious heart attack. And he said, but people are consenting, they're willing to do it. And we said, well, it doesn't matter. Why are they willing to do it? Well, they're all my patients. Of course they're willing to do it. Now, this was not freedom. This was not people making a choice. They were being forced into taking part in an experiment. We have medical students who are forced to take part in experiments within the medical school, and we're trying to stop that now. In evangelism, in apologetics, you can force people. You can use a kind of verbal violence. You can use a kind of manipulation of people. No force or violence, and no manipulation of the truth. I listened to Radio 4 the other day. It was a program called Quote on Quotes. And they talked about Hitler. And they said, you know, Hitler, he was really good at what he did. Now, that's really quite frightening. The danger is, in presenting apologetics, we can manipulate the truth. We can also have conscious omission. How many health and wealth gospel people promise every need will be met? Come to Jesus, you will be wealthy. Come to Jesus, you will be fit. They never tell you about the suffering. They never tell you about the cost of discipleship, which was why Bonhoeffer was so concerned there'd be no false emphasis, that we did not offer cheap grace, because grace is costly. It was costly to Jesus Christ, and it will be costly to you and to me. There must be no cheap grace. We have to tell people the whole truth. You cannot wear the crown if you don't bear the cross. That's the only way. There is no alternative. Jesus did not say, come to me and you will have a bed of roses for life. Take up your cross every day and follow me. The whole truth. No blurring of the difference and distinctives. No blurring of the difference and distinctives. That's why I like that Flannery O'Connor quote, the truth will make you odd. Because it makes me want to stop and say, is there a right kind of oddity? Is there a right kind of peculiarity that I as a Christian should have? Should I be different? Elaine used to work for the Open University. I was invited to give a lecture on the proofs of God. I managed in 1 hour 26 different proofs of God. To be precise, there were 25 different ones, and then 26 was the cumulative case, 1 to 25 added together. Now, the sign of being a really good lecturer is you speak for so long, there's no time left for questions, and I failed. There were 2 minutes left. There's always one. Every gathering, always one. This guy got up at the back. He said, Dr. Cook. That's always a bad sign. Dr. Cook, he said, there's only one thing that stops me being a Christian. I thought, come on, tell me. I'll knock it down. The guy will be gloriously converted. Come on, tell me, what stops you being a Christian? He says, the thing that stops me being a Christian is I can't see any difference between the way Christians live and the way non-Christians live. And I did not have a clever or a witty or a humorous answer to that, because it was absolutely true. We blur the distinctives, we blur the differences. Let's Christians be different. There is a moral concern in presenting the gospel, in sharing the gospel, in living the gospel. Do not blur the differences. Do not blur the distinctives. Do not surrender. Let's not modify in a false kind of way. Let's be true to the nature of truth. The very first lecture I gave, I had 96 points, and the students told me it was too many. So the second week, I had 48 points, and the students told me it was too many. The third week, I had 24 points, and the students told me it was too many. And I said, I cannot give you less. It would not do justice to the subject. And sometimes, particularly in philosophical ideas, I'm sure that Bill and others who teach philosophy will know this feeling. You explain something, they don't understand it. So you explain it again, they don't understand it. You give them some illustration, they don't understand it. And there comes a point where you just have to say, that's the way it is. It's difficult, it's complicated. I cannot simplify it any further, because if I did, it would actually falsify. It would oversimplify. And sometimes in the analysis of our culture, in the analysis of postmodernity, in the analysis of the issues facing us, in the analysis of context, in the analysis of people, we oversimplify. We pretend there is only one way of doing it. Beware of that oversimplification. Beware of a false kind of accommodation. I'm a fellow and chaplain of Green College. As chaplain, I have to perform various public functions for the college. And I was approached by the warden 2 or 3 years ago to perform a marriage ceremony for a Jew and an atheist. And they wanted to make sure in this ceremony that God was not mentioned. Yahweh could be mentioned, but not God. And Jesus could not be mentioned. Now, designing a liturgy which avoids the mention of God and the mention of Jesus is a little bit hard. And it's the same kind of hardness when people have multi-faith prayers. How do we produce a prayer that the Muslims, the Hindus, the Sikhs, the Christians, and the Jews can all affirm together? The danger is of a false kind of accommodation, where we fit the gospel into a very false shape. But I also want to say, do not retreat into the ghetto. Do not retreat into the ghetto. I have to be careful how I say this, but having spent 24 years in Oxford, now going off to Wheaton, is always in danger of retreating into a very nice, but nevertheless a ghetto. And so I'm going to continue to come back to Oxford every Trinity term and every summer to keep the links there. Because it's very important, having worked in a secularized context, to set in a heathen context, that if you want to opt into a Christian context, you do not settle in a ghetto. That's the death of apologetics, living in the ghetto, understanding the ghetto, communicating to the ghetto. People think if you talk to Christians, that's all you need to do. There's a world out there dying without Christ. The morality, a concern for appropriate methods. I want to conclude not just by talking about the morality of concerns, morality of truth, morality of persons and relationships, the morality of methodology, but also the morality of distinctiveness. I want to say something positively about what should be the distinctives for people engaged in the task of apologetics. I think our beliefs are distinctive. We should be distinctive in expressing our beliefs because they are distinctive. They challenge human knowledge. The question this morning in relation to Paul's rejection of human wisdom. There is a clear choice. There's a belief system which rests on an understanding of God and what God has revealed to us over and against a purely human construction. And we have to reject things which are purely human constructions. That doesn't mean that as humans we have not a God-given role in constructing proper ways which are based on God's truth and open to God's leading and direction. That's quite different from something which imagines that human beings alone can produce a system. Our beliefs, the distinctiveness of our beliefs, the distinctiveness of our lifestyle, and here in particular I want to mention love. The early church challenged the world in which it lived, that pluralistic, that relativistic world, how they love one another. There was such a quality of relating. I remember when I worked in the seminary, a car broke down outside, and this couple, clearly on drugs, clearly living together, clearly into all kinds of things, they couldn't afford to get the car mended. And so they were invited by the Theological College to come and to live for a few days. And after 4 or 5 days, they said, you know, this is the most unusual community we've ever been. We've never seen such love, love towards us as strangers and love towards each other. And we thought, is this the same place that we work in? Because when you live there all the time, it seemed more like, you know, heaven above with those we love, or that will be true glory. Earth below with those we know well. That's another story. Our communities, our apologetics should be based on a lifestyle which is consistent and loving. It's also based on the authority of Scripture. It's important that somewhere we address, certainly in the communities that have been talked about a number of times, the authority of Scripture. What does that mean? What does it mean in terms of inspiration? What does it mean in terms of interpretation? What does it mean in terms of application? The authority in the church. The authority in the church, which should be a praying community. It's very interesting. Somebody at lunch commented on Richard's talking about the way in which people coming into the church, it's not enough that they just feel comfortable. They have to be challenged. They have to be converted. And this person was saying, you know, we only have converted people in our church. Wish that were true. It's interesting that we're not actually always familiar when we use the word church what we're talking about. And so we need to understand what is a proper kind of authority in the church. And one of the authority, I believe, rests on the praying community. The praying community and the discipling community in the sense of the learning community. I'm always fearful in contexts where people don't want to learn anymore, where they think they've got it all sewn up, whether they've got the strategy or the preaching or their church life. Authority in the church. What's a proper authority as well as an improper one? What is the authority of transformed lives and communities? You see, there should be a sense in which our morality is distinct. Our apologetic is distinctive because it changes and transforms peoples, individuals, and community. And that's important that our life is one of transformed lives and transformed communities and the authority of transforming lives and communities. Something about ourselves, something about other people. The integration of the public and the private. a disciplined community and a disciplining community. In the work of apologetics, we can either kind of just say the first thing that comes into your head. If you've listened, when I was in the States, I did some after-dinner impromptu extempore speaking. I was on the kind of debate circuit and you went round. It was wonderful. You know, as a Scotsman, I got free travel and all I had to do was speak. It was just great. Sometimes you'd be in a competition with people from all over the States and people would get up and they'd just speak, and it was total drivel because they'd never actually thought about what they were going to do. So I learned a very simple trick. In impromptu speaking, they used to write down three topics and they would give you the topic. And from the moment you turned the topic over, the clock was ticking. And so I would go in and there would be my piece of paper and I would say, ladies and gentlemen, I want to analyse this particular topic in three different ways. I want to look at this topic in terms of, and you know, something to be the past, the present, the future, whatever it was, and only then would I turn it over. And always you got full marks and all the rest of it because they were so impressed that you could analyse it. But of course that was because I'd really tried hard and worked hard and thought hard beforehand. I was once invited to take part in a programme. I arrived in London, it was a Saturday, and the newspaper, this was a secular newspaper, headline, Jesus did not die. I could not believe here in the 1990s, here was this headline in the programme. I went to my meeting, went back home, and my wife said, the BBC are trying to reach you. I want to take part in the Sunday programme. So I phoned up and they said, have you seen the papers? I said, oh, yes. They said, we want you to debate with the man who's written this report in a medical journal that Jesus didn't die. I said, you need a New Testament person. You need Tom Wright, somebody who really knows it. No, we want you to do it. So eventually I agreed to do this. I spent a sleepless night thinking, what on earth was I going to say live on radio the next day debating with this guy? Came the interview and they let him go first. They asked him, why did he think Jesus hadn't died? And it was that old heresy, you know, Jesus really fainted, and you know, the poor Romans who'd never seen a dead person before thought that because he'd fainted that he, you know, he needed to be kind of taken and buried, and the people who'd never buried anybody before took him, and eventually he was, you know, having been whipped and flogged and thrown to prison and on a cross, he was able to push away this stone that was heavily in himself and all this kind of stuff. It's an old heresy. And so the presenter said, Dr. Cook from Oxford, you know, this, I always like this kind of stuff. Dr. Cook from Oxford, can you tell us what you think? And I said, well, I'm always worried when a doctor diagnoses a patient over the telephone. But I'm really worried about a doctor who diagnoses a patient 2,000 years ago that he never saw and gives us a diagnose. And so Trevor Barnes said to him, so doctor, what do you think of that? And doctor went, Now, that wasn't a quick line. It wasn't a spur of the moment. It was spent hours in prayer and thought and reflection. And the work of apologetics will only flourish if you actually put the effort in beforehand. I plead with you, in the practice of apologetics, be model, act modelly, reflect modelly on all that you're doing. And then with God's grace, we might do something. Thank you.
We just take 2 minutes for reflections and reactions in small groups. And
under your second heading, morality of truth, you said we must resist subjecting Christian truth to false standards. Why don't you just elaborate a bit more on what you mean by that, some examples?
This is a question about a point about whether or not we should resist subjecting Christian truth to false standards, a question about what kind of examples there might be. In the scientific realm, often people give explanations of, for example, homosexuality. At lunchtime, we had a discussion about homosexuality at my table. And at the table, they were saying, what is a homosexual? How do we understand homosexuals? And so if I look at some of the kind of medical or the psychological or the psychotherapeutic kinds of accounts, then the danger is that what I do is I say, well, being homosexual is what these things say. Whereas the Bible has a very clear perspective, not so much about homosexual people, but rather about homosexual activity. And homosexual activity arises out of particular desires that people have, particular temptations that people have. And the danger is that we lose that biblical perspective about the truth because we're so bound up in finding some kind of absolute view, which is the one and only answer about homosexuality. The gay Christian liberation, lesbian and gay Christian movement were very concerned when they thought they discovered a gay gene, because they thought there is one gene, if you've got that gene, that will make you homosexual. Now, here was an example where all of their understanding of homosexuality went out the window, and they fastened on this one thing, and it became the only kind of truth. And what are we going to do in light of that? And, you know, they were talking about legislation and preventing people aborting on demand, even though they'd always argued in favour of abortion on demand. But here was one situation where you didn't allow when they were getting rid of gay people and so on. So it's interesting, I think. But there was an example where you tied your particular view to a particular world view. And I'm just anxious that in Christianity, sometimes, particularly in apologetics, when we're working with different views and different disciplines, that we so embrace that discipline that its criteria and its standards become the standard. I think that's what lay behind the question this morning about human reasoning over and against a biblical perspective. I don't think a biblical perspective is not human, but I don't think it's only human. And so I think the danger is that if we have a purely a human standard in and of itself, which is all sufficient, that we use that. And we use it justifiably, we think, because we think it's going to win the person. And again, it's the end justifies the means. I think that's what concerns me.
This is a related question, Dr. Cook.
Notice he said Dr. Cook. That's the right word.
When you were talking about concern for the proper tests of truth, and you mentioned the coherence theory and things like that, it's a concern of mine that there are improper ways of applying the coherence test. For example, Christian doctrines. If you try to make the Trinity too coherent, you will end up with one of the historical Trinitarian heresies, guaranteed.
Right.
And I've seen it in a recent letter in Christianity Today. Some pastor trying to make it rational ended up in modalism.
Right. It's interesting, the slide in the words, which I think reveal part of the problem and the proper concern which you have. The difference between saying coherent and rational. Do we believe that the doctrine of the Trinity is incoherent? Do we believe that the doctrine of the Trinity is irrational? Well, it all depends what your standard of coherence, your standard of rationality is. And the standards I'm concerned with is it makes sense. Does it or does it not make sense? And of course, if I believe that God is a revealing God and that God is acting in different ways in relation to the world and indeed in his own being, then it seems to me the Trinity makes perfectly good sense. In the same kind of way, I think it is possible to say, well, there is a rationality there. There's a rationality which is about, if given the nature of God, what makes sense? So if what we know about God is true, what can we then deduce from that particular thing? And we can deduce certain things that God would not do. In the debate about HIV and AIDS, the notion that God made AIDS thunderbolts and then threw them down and hit particular people, but actually managed to hit lots of innocent people as well, it was a false view of God that made it a false kind of account. It was incoherent because it did not fit with the rationality of the nature of God. So, yes, we have to be careful, and yes, of course, you can abuse all kinds of tests. I always think that, you know, people say that the Bible says there is no God. And so it does. I mean, the whole text is the fool has said in his heart there is no God. But you can abuse the Bible. You can abuse all things. Yeah.
So in other words, could you say that you're working from a coherence view of truth that argues from the Bible?
Yes, I think so. Well, more from the nature of God.
Yeah.
I think it's the nature of God which informs the nature of the Bible and what God... because God is a speaking and revealing God, that the Bible is as it is. It's not bibliolatry. It's the nature of God. But I believe that God has spoken through his word, and therefore we have a reliable guide that way.
David, you talk about the importance of being different and maintaining those distinctives, and about the morality of distinctiveness, and that, you know, to quote you, the truth will make you odd. In your experience, how have you coped with that in the light of the tension of wanting to be all things to all people and availing yourself to different sets of friends that you might have?
This is a question about the way in which you show integrity in relation to being all things to all people. How do we actually go about that? I think if we believe that the truth will make you free. And I used the Flannery O'Connor, not my quote, the truth will make you odd. I wanted to be provocative, to make a stop and say, what is distinctive, what is peculiar about who we are as Christian people? And I would like to think that in the Christian community, not so much myself, but in the Christian community, people see some characteristics, love, the way of relating, which is quite different, which challenges, which is different and distinctive. Now, I think that if in the different contexts where you're trying to communicate the gospel, where you're trying to offer an apologetic account, always that you are responsive to people, always that you're concerned with them rather than about me. I think that sometimes in evangelism, I'm a bit worried that evangelists are more interested in themselves and thinking that they did justice to the gospel rather than the gospel itself and the other person. Now, I think you can have a consistent, I think Paul was consistent, it doesn't matter whether you're a Jew or a Gentile, all things, I'm always going to be the same because I'm concerned about you and I'm going to make sure that you have heard the gospel. Now, you may be a Jew, so how I present it will be differ from how I present it to a Gentile, but the key thing is I'm presenting the gospel because of my concern for you. So I think that's what I'm asking. Are there distinctives that we have as Christians, individual and community, which actually stand out over and against the world? And the danger is we play them down. The desire to fit in. I think of in the student scene, Lane was talking about sexual behaviour. I know many young students who engage in sexual activity because they're lonely. And because they think this is the way that they can have friends. This is the way they can be the same as everybody else. Now, actually, they find it doesn't stop you being lonely, and it may make you the same in the sense you've got to buy somebody else who doesn't 19 pints, but in the end, it doesn't actually make you feel any better about yourself or make you relate better or build better relationships and friendships. So the person who is different, who does not behave in that way, then that distinctive is something to celebrate rather than something to hide. The Anglican Church produced a report about cohabitation, which was called Something to Celebrate. And it seemed to me there was a danger that you take something that the world does and you say, isn't this wonderful? You know, we can celebrate this. Well, maybe it's not quite so wonderful. Should we be celebrating the distinctiveness rather than ways in which we can say, oh, well, we can find a way of making this acceptable to us? Exhaustion?
Related to that, I was wondering about your point regarding respect to people and the integrity of others. When you meet people who may be involved in different types of activity that we would consider sinful, and they're aware of that, how do you still show respect to people who are living in relationships with a lover or homosexual relationships?
Yes, this is a question about how you show respect to people who are living in sin and they recognize they're living in sin. I think the basic way of showing respect is to say, you know what you're doing is wrong. I remember a homosexual coming to me and talking about his homosexual practice and the fact that in order to con some people, he'd gone out with this woman and he'd made love to her to persuade people that actually he was worth having this job because really there was nothing different about him. And he told me this and he said, why don't you condemn me? I said, because you are yourself. You know that you are condemned. You know that you've done something wrong. You don't need me to add to it. But I was happy to add to it. And it seems to me that giving people respect is telling them the truth. And if the truth is that they are abusing people, well, you tell them the truth. I don't think that's showing no respect.
Just a very practical question. When you are having a conversation with a non-Christian or speaking to a non-Christian group and then taking questions afterwards, often people just try to put people off track or distract or try to undermine your message by throwing in a red herring question, which might be a valid question but nothing really to do with the talk. So, for example, you could be speaking on does God exist, and then somebody asks the homosexuality question. To what extent do you pursue that? Do you see it as a great opportunity?
This is a question about how you deal with red herring questions which try and throw you off tack. I always like the way Margaret Thatcher was taught to respond to questions that she didn't like. It wasn't necessarily things that would try to throw her off track. She'd say, well, that's a very interesting question, but before I answer it, I'd like to say this. And she said what she wanted to say. Now, I think we need to do more than that. If I'm giving a lecture on the nature of God, somebody asks me a question about homosexuality, then I want time together. I'd say, well, before you understand why we believe that homosexual practice is something which is less than desirable, we need to understand the nature of God and that God does not look favorably on sin. When we do something wrong, God calls a spade a speed, and whether it's heterosexual misbehavior or homosexual misbehavior, any kind of sexual behavior is condemned by God because that's the nature of God. So what you're looking for is to find a way of tying in what looks like a red herring into the thing that you're affirming. Now, I think the best way of doing that is by affirming what you want to affirm first of all, and then answering the question so there is no excuse. I think it's a dishonor to the individual not to ask the question. And even if it's a red herring, and even if I know it's a red herring, and he or she knows it's a red herring, I think it's still important to remove the excuse. But I also then have the opportunity, and I like to take it before I answer the red herring, to make sure that I've said what was the thing that really is the issue, and to reinforce that and to repeat it. Often people say... I say to people, you ought to take part in these phone-in programs. You know, there are endless phone-in programs. It's a very way of cheap radio. People say, oh, I never know what to say. And they'll make a fool of me. And so I say to them, this is what you do. What you do is you write down exactly what you're going to say. And then when you get through, the people will say, what do you want to say? And you read them what you want to say. And they'll say, oh, that's very interesting. And so because they're desperate, not a lot of people phone in programs, you've got a good chance of getting on. So then you get on and the presenter will say, what do you have to say about this issue? And so you read them what they want to say. And then they try and make a fool of you. They take something and they ask you a red herring, they deal with something else. And when you say, well, I don't know about that, but all I can say is you read it again. And then you've twice on air been able to make the statement.
David, you talked about consciously omitting things. How does that apply? I would perhaps answer the question, what about those who've never heard? I would give a different approach to a Christian or a non-Christian. How do you avoid it becoming consciously omitting something, and how do you help clarify things for someone who's coming from nowhere in their understanding?
This is a question about omission of the truth, and is there a difference between communicating, for example, about the loss to the Christian, to the non-Christian? How do you avoid a wrong kind of judgment there? I think one of the ways is by asking, am I telling the truth in a way which the other person can understand? Now notice it's the truth in a way the other person can understand. And then secondly, asking them whether or not it actually deals with the real question. I think sometimes, particularly if you teach people technique, what happens is they do the technique and they think, I've done it. Rather than the expression is an opportunity, an invitation for people to engage with you in the kind of way, you know, Elaine, here's this girl who gets up and says, I want to tell you about Jesus. And Elaine thinks, great, tell me about Jesus. And then she finds, actually, it's, you know, I had a nice feeling when I walk along the beach. And so you say, well, why do you do that? It was an opportunity for a discussion. It wasn't the kind of the end of it. I haven't given you the one answer, and that's the end of the discussion. You want to make sure that the other person actually does understand. And in all of, you know, in good teaching, never mind in good apologetics or evangelism, you want to make sure that the question the person is really after. When doctors interview patients, the presenting problem is not usually the real problem. And so you have to have a way of answering the presenting problem, but then making sure there's nothing more, something behind that, which is the real issue. And so in apologetics, the question that people ask up front may not actually be the real difficulty, stumbling block, and actually unpacking that is really very important. I'm happy to carry on, but I'm not sure what the brothers here are saying.
I think our time has gone. Thank you very much. We have